Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Kyle Turner.
On the show this week, Reddit takes on Wall Street in Dumb Money, and I spoke to its director, Craig Gillespie. Almodovar turns his talents to a queer Western in Strange Way of Life. And on Film Club, it's Ang Lee's modern classic, Brokeback Mountain. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Kyle, I'm so excited to have you on the show. I've been a big fan of your work for quite a long time. But for those people out there, I mean, I can't imagine who these people are, but who don't know who you are, could you give yourself a little intro?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I'm a huge fan of Little White Lies and Truth in Movies, so it's an honor to be here. My name is Kyle Turner. I'm a freelance film critic based in Brooklyn, New York, whose work has been featured in GQ, W Magazine, and the New York Times. And I'm also the author of The Queer Film Guide, 100 Great Movies That Tell LGBTQI Plus Stories. And I'm excited to talk about money and stock markets and queer Westerns and all that great stuff.
Yeah, it does feel like quite a sexy week, because like I would argue that Dumb Money is basically all about cucking. But but yeah, I want to hear more about this book. Tell us all about it. So you're going through this kind of centenary seem to be the theme at the moment. We've got the 100th issue of Little White Lies, and you're going through, what, 100 films, is it, in your book?
Yes. It's 100 movies throughout queer film history, sort of like a 1001 movies to see before you die type book, but a chronological survey of queer cinema, starting in 1919 with Different from the Others, all the way up to 2022 with Fire Island. And it's been a tremendous privilege. It came out in May and from Smith Street Books in Rizzoli, and should be available from fine book retailers everywhere. Although I believe it's sold out on Amazon, which is both cool and dismaying in as much as like hoping people are able to access it. But it's been a tremendous honor, and I've just been very grateful to have the opportunity to write about something that I'm really passionate about and that I care a lot about, because I've always found that film criticism and cinema more broadly has been a tool of self-knowledge for me. And so it's especially in these times when in the Western world, there's a lot of anti-trans and anti-queer rhetoric happening, and it's seeping into material policy in the United States, at least what I can speak from here. And I hope that people are, regardless of whether they get the book or not, are able to find community and find objects and artifacts from culture that affirm who they are and give them an opportunity to explore what queerness can be for them on their own terms. And so it's been a real pleasure to be able to share some of the things that I really care about, because I've had the opportunity to program movies at different theaters in New York and also programmed a couple things in LA. And it's been very cool to share those things that I really care about with new audiences.
Well, I do have bad news in that like it's just as bad, if not worse, on this side of the Atlantic. Rhetoric, not on this podcast, but certainly throughout media. But I mean, like in terms of like queer cinema, are there any kind of surprising entries in your book? Maybe like ones that like films that people really wouldn't know about that kind of you do view as being part of like the canon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I have tried to, not to blame you or anything, but I like to think of this book, even though it's called The Queer Film Guide, I like to think of it as a queer film guide. It's hopefully a starting point for people to develop a curiosity about the different forms and shapes that queer cinema has taken over the years. And so you have everything from, like, classics like Brokeback Mountain and Moonlight and Sylvia Scarlett and Bringing Up Baby, but you also have things like Jennifer's Body, Seat of Chucky, My Hustler, Tongues Untied, Paris is Burning. I thought that if this was going to be an object or something that I was encouraging people to purchase in their home, that it should be a unique and idiosyncratic enough collection of films that they weren't going to find anywhere on the internet. Because you can Google best queer movies and come up with 100 lists, but I wanted this to be both my perspective and also just like an unusual one. Like, I want to have something like Boys in the Sand, the Wakefield Pool art gay porno, next to something like The Duke of Burgundy, the Peter Strickland film. And so it was a really fun exercise to see, like, what is it like to play with the idea of canon making in the first place? And it's also what I think is fun about the book is that I actually cheated, and there are more than 100 films in the book. Each main entry, there are 100 of them, gets a sidebar recommendation, a wine pairing, if you will. And so there are technically 200 movies in the book.
Well, I mean, you had me at arch gay porno sold.
Yep, yep.
But David, like, I mean, we did have a little bit of a chat about this last week, but you are now maybe relaxing a little bit into the fact that, like, the Little White Lies 100th issue is now out there.
Relaxing? What is that? I don't know that word.
I don't know. When I've worked with you, I've found you replying to emails at, like, 11:30 p.m. So I do worry about you, David.
I've also gotten emails from David, like, on a weekend. And, like, what are you doing?
That's just how I roll. That's just how I roll. You know, I like to just keep on top of things. But you two are exceptions. I'm very bad at emails, as some other listeners may know. So only the VIPs get that treatment. So, yeah, no, I'm relaxing a little bit. But it's really nice to have the 100th issue kind of out there now, and there's been a bit of, you know, few responses from it, and people seem to like it, which is good. And the idea now is that we don't necessarily want to rest on our laurels and, you know, sweep it aside and move on to the next one. And I think it's actually, you know, working in the world of print media, it's very easy to, once the magazine is out, to just switch off and move on to the next project and be like, thinking in this cyclical way. And, you know, your mind just shifts over to what's the next creative project I can do. And sometimes, and it's really hard to be like, oh no, you have to keep talking about this and nurturing it and promoting it and doing things to actually remind people that this thing is out there still, while simultaneously doing the other magazine. Hence the midnight emails. You can get the magazine, and you know, I don't necessarily want to talk too much about what's inside the magazine, because I think it'd be cool for people to discover that for themselves. But suffice to say that I think we've got some really amazing texts in there. We've got some amazing interviews, lots of directors that we love and have talked with through the years have kind of connected with us again and talked about their kind of formative epiphanies. And we have a lot of people talking about this idea of when they first had looked through a viewfinder of a camera and what they saw, which is quite a kind of fun, novel, unique thing to hear about filmmakers. But we're also doing a little film season at the Prince Charles. Hannah Strong presented Inside Llewyn Davis last night. It's three films that have all were all Little White Lies cover films in the past. So we're doing Inside Llewyn Davis. I'm presenting George Romero's Land of the Dead on 35 in at the end of October, and Adam Woodward is doing Todd Haynes' Carol on 35 as a kind of lovely Christmas special. So yeah, that's the thing we're doing. We're also doing maybe this is a sort of first time announcement for some people, but we're also doing an exhibition in collaboration with London Film Festival. London Film Festival has a LFF for free strand. During the festival, they have like free events and walk-in things that are happening throughout the city and something like aligned with some of their key venues. And we're doing a Little White Lies 100 exhibition at place called Sea Containers down by Oxo Tower. It's called the Coin Street Gallery. So drop by. We're going to have 100 magazines, all original magazines, hung on the wall with the new covers presented and framed as well. So, and we're going to be down there. We're going to record a live podcast. We're going to do an event, and we're going to talk about making magazines in the sort of 21st century, the financial imperatives and creative stresses of doing that. So yeah, I'm going to stop now because that seemed like a lot, but I feel like I packed a lot in there.
I'm sad I won't be able to attend, but congratulations as a long-time reader.
Spiritually, you will be there, I hope.
I definitely will be there spiritually haunting different vendors.
Well, I mean, that does lead us on to, well, not so much a haunted film as like a film about like the cursed landscape that we currently live in.
Good segue.
We should get a move on. Thank you. I'm a pro. First up, it's Dumb Money.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Dumb Money is based on the true story of a group of ragtag investors from the Reddit page Wall Street Bets who banded together to put a squeeze on at least two hedge funds that betted that GameStop shares would fall. But before we get into the film, I spoke to its director, Craig Gillespie, about his stranger-than-fiction tale.
This is kind of the end of a bit of a tour. So it was Toronto and then kind of traveling around
New York,
the whole...
And out here. No, but there's more. We're going to go to the San Sebastian Film Festival next week and then the Zurich Film Festival.
Do you enjoy that side of things? That kind of like festival tracking around?
I try to. it's both like, you know, it's such a bizarre relationship you have with your work where it's like it's so personal. It's like you're so in the trenches with it, working with actors, working with your crew, and it's such an intimate process, and then you've just got to sort of throw it out there and see what happens, see how it's received.
Well, I mean, that I've seen, everybody seems to be like really enjoying it, but it's that kind of strange thing, because I think when people come to something with anything to do with finances, there's a bit of like, I don't understand any of this, will I be able to like...
No, that was part of my learning curve as well. I'm not involved in the finance world, but I got to live this phenomenon with my son, who was living with us at the time during COVID. He was 24, and he started early on in Wall Street Bets and did really well with it.
Oh, wow.
Timed it perfectly. Got very similar to the college students in the film. Mm-hmm. Got out that morning. The next morning, Robinhood, which was the app that you would buy the stock with, put a freeze on it, and it created the stock.
Yeah.
People were outraged. So I lived through all of this with him, and that intensity... And seeing what was happening online with the 8 million followers, that was the way that I approached this story.
God, I mean, I do remember it kind of happening at the time and saying to my husband that the same thing happened with Bitcoin, where she was like, should I get in on this? And he's like, if you've heard of it, it's already too late. Like, early days.
And then I did that. I got into it after all of this, after seeing what he was doing. But this was a little different than like the Bitcoin situation, because this was about, and I think it happened because of COVID, and COVID was such a profound change for all of us, and the loss of lives that were happening with loved ones, the loss of work, like businesses folding, small businesses, and this real lack of government aid that was happening in the United States. There was this real disparity of wealth.
Yeah.
And that frustration, like, landed, like, directed at the stock. There was 8 million people that started rallying around this, and realizing if they pumped the stock up, it was really going to hit Wall Street where it hurts, which is in their wallets, as well as they get to make some money. So they're really, like, in a way, it was this kind of protest, this financial protest against what was happening. And then when there was a freeze by Robinhood on that and Reddit shut down Wall Street Bets, which was this forum for everybody talking, that anger and frustration at feeling like the system is rigged, and then having this... like, this actual physical evidence of what was going on, and then having it go to Congress, that really, really resonated with me. And that's something I wanted to be able to leave the film with.
Yeah. I mean, but you also kind of don't shy away from the fact that there's a lot of like not great stuff on Reddit. Like, that's
not
perfect community.
I think it's like, you know, yes, they refer to themselves as apes and degenerates. Mm-hmm. And they took themselves, I think in some ways, the core group of Wall Street Bets was almost about like this un-PC world and platform that they were on. when this movement started, it was 400,000 people, I think, on Wall Street Bets. In that 8 weeks leading up to the stock reaching an all-time high, it got to 8 million.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of people that came in that didn't reflect that, but we needed to show just the environment that it was in and the way that everybody communicates. So out of the gate, yeah, the movie kind of hits you in the face with that.
I've got to say, I also really loved the, I mean, like, I guess there's kind of like the kind of hyper-masculinity kind of like joking around of Reddit, but like that combined with like the hip-hop, yeah. I like really kind of loved that sort of tongue-in-cheek masculinity.
There was, and it's the wealth of just the footage that we had to pull from. It's like all of the memes in the movie, all the TikToks, they're all real. And it's all, you know, they're all actual memes that were happening at the time. All the news anchors, AOC, like all those interviews, the Dave Portney, the Elon Musk interview. It's all the actual interviews that were happening right then in that moment. Stephen Colbert talking, it's like that's what he was saying.
Yeah.
So we managed to be able to pull all of these clips to the White House press conference.
Mm.
It's all the actual footage and give it a context of just the scale of what was happening.
I mean, how do you approach something that's got that scale? Because not only we're talking 8 million people involved, all these different financial people involved, politicians involved, how do you, like, pare down what's actually going to, like, give the, like, most interesting kind of story within
there,
this
it event? It was both an advantage and, like, a disadvantage in a way. It's like the one thing we realized, which was interesting, and this happened a lot in post. I worked with Kirk Baxter, the editor on this, who I hadn't worked with before. He's done... Fincher's movies for the last, David Fincher for the last 17 years. And we've worked briefly in some commercials together, but it was almost like we were doing two movies.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the film that we were doing, the drama and the scenes, which is very straightforward. And then we had this like unwieldy like tiger trying to grab by the tail that it could be anything we wanted.
Yeah.
And that was an exploration in post to sort of figure out when do we introduce these memes? When do we introduce the mass media, because that came later in the story. How do we use the exposition in the film? And we actually had started out having the exposition, a lot of it was with the actors in the scenes. And we realized in a nice way, we can take that off of their shoulders and stay with them emotionally and put the exposition into these TikToks and into, you know, like newscasters explaining the context. And you got the nice added bonus that you get the real world context of what's happening.
Yeah, I'm kind of really glad that I've done a big deep dive because it just seems to get weirder and weirder the closer you get into it. And you're just like, well, what do you mean that's what happened next? And then the community still exists as like kind of all like a strange.
It's out there. And now I'm hoping they like the film. We'll see. So they're going to have a strong voice in it. And that was part of like really trying to like honor the community in a way.
Yeah.
It's like we knew that they're going to be the vicious detractors or advocates for it, you know? And it's like it is a huge community.
I think one of like honestly like the most strangest details is like you mentioned David Fincher, but you also have that double connection because am I right I think the Winklevoss twins were also involved in the film.
That's it's sort of like two steps removed. Ben Mezrich, who wrote The Social Network, the book, and he also wrote The Anti-Social Network, which this film is based on. So through him and having a deal with them, they came with the book.
Oh, okay. That kind of makes more sense.
Yeah.
And like, you're obviously collaborating with Seth Rogen again, you know, having like, and I loved Pam and Tommy, but like, I mean, what is it that you kind of enjoy about like working together?
Seth is like, he's such a versatile actor. It's like, obviously he can do the comedy, but he's also like, done some beautiful dramatic things in Steve Jobs, for instance. And getting to work with him on Pam and Tommy, which is really a character and not Seth Rogen, as we know him, he really did such a beautiful job with that. And I was excited to work with him again. And what I loved in this one is we're casting him against type. Like, you think of him as the everyman. You think of him as the sort of lovable jokester in a lot of ways. And in this one, he plays Gabe Plotkin from Melvin Capital, which is the guy that the whole Reddit community is going after. And the stakes are very high for him and very real. And it's actually much more of a dramatic role. Online, he's absolutely the villain. So it was important to me, and it was inherent in the script that Rebecca Angelo and Lauren Shuka Bloom wrote, that it's all gray. These are all individuals. It's like the system is broken.
Yeah.
The system is what people are taking advantage of. But thought it was important to remind us that he's like a human being with a family, you know, and just he's trying to do his thing, like within the world, in the context of how he lives. So I needed him to be accessible, and Seth has that.
Yeah. There is something just very infuriating, like no matter how likable the person is, but just that kind of class of people kind of didn't do the pandemic. Like, no, they just didn't.
It's a completely different lifestyle. They're completely oblivious to the real struggles that are going on and the reality of it. And it was, you know, there was that disparity. And that was part of the whole COVID opportunity as well, to be able to show how it affects the different classes. And it took just down to them not having to wear masks with their staff walking around in masks, you know, or being in Florida where nobody wears masks.
Yeah, well, for multiple reasons. yeah, I mean, so Paul Dano doesn't look that much like Keith Gill, but like, what was it that you saw in him that made him right for that?
Paul is such an unbelievable versatile actor. Mm-hmm. That year he had Batman and the Fablemans, like that range.
Yeah.
And I'd always, you know, loved Paul's work and was very familiar with it. The only thing I hadn't seen, and my son suggested it, was Swiss Army Man. And it's such an unbelievably sort of like joyous, innocent performance that he has in that. And there was that quality to the actual Keith Gill. Like, on his post, he has such a joy with what he talks about. He sits down 7 hours a session, like, once a week, and can talk about stock. But he talks about it in such an earnest, like, playful way, and is so vulnerable with it. And so I really wanted that accessibility. And when I saw that performance from Paul, I was like, wow, that's the quality that this guy has. That there's just no cynicism in that performance from that character. And I think that's why there was 8 million people that were rooting for him. Because the internet can be really tough on on people. So to have 8 million people sort of identify with him and recognize that and trust him, that's what we needed in Paul's performance. And I, you know, he did such a beautiful job.
Yeah, I mean, it is that thing of, it almost does become a cult, but like, it doesn't feel sinister because it has got that kind of, you know, like, he's got a sincerity.
He's not trying to be a leader. He's just standing by his own convictions. And it's, you know, he goes from 55,000, which is his life savings, which he invests, and he's married with a child, you know, with a 1-year-old, so they've got a lot at stake, and he gets to 49 million. And people are just like waiting to see what he's going to do. It's like, because he's been so invested in this, he's been preaching it for a year, advocating for it, and now it's happening. So he just by default becomes like the lightning rod that attracts all of this attention.
It's kind of a difficult thing to believe that people really wouldn't just sell.
It's this very complex situation, because the reason that the stock's going so high is because they're all holding, which makes the stock go higher because of this, because of Seth's character that has put a huge short on it. So he's trying to drive the stock price down, and then they get to drive it up. And because of that, they've got to hang on till the last second. They're trying to figure out when that will be, when it reaches its peak. And it just keeps escalating. So there's that inherent tension of like, when's the moment to get out? And like, if you sell too soon, you'll be kicking yourself, because you see, like, I mean, literally the day that this really happened, it went from $100 to $400 in 24 hours. So the amount of money people started making, also because it wasn't just, it's just dealing in stocks, they were dealing in options, which is a whole other conversation. But the very basic idea of the options is it can be like 50-fold what your investment is. So that's how you can have, you know, Anthony Ramos starting with $146 and going to $200,000. And so those stakes are incredibly high and life-changing for them.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of a thread that was like very interested to me. There's someone that is actually also tangibly being affected by like GameStop being undervalued. I mean, was that based on a real person? Were there
GameStop? That's Gabe Plotkin. Oh yeah, he's the company has since gone out of business. You'll see at the end, there's a testimony of him at the SEC, which was verbatim what we used in the film. They ended up losing, not to give anything away, but they, you know, he ended up losing $6.7 billion. And ultimately, the company folded like 6 months later.
All right. Well, final question. Are there any, I mean, like, you've kind of, you know, iTonya kind of changed her image so much. And then, you know, obviously with these, we're kind of, and I think with the Pamela Anderson, we're sort of really re-examining these people and events that people think they know, but they don't really. I mean, is there anything recent that maybe, like, you'd like to take another look at?
I just wait to see what, you know, what presents itself to me. It's like I try to stay open, and it's so much about the material and you know, in this case, that was the script that came in that they did such a beautiful job with. So I don't know what it's going to be. I keep trying not to stay in this world real well and venture out, but then I get attracted to projects that are kind of fascinating. And this was one of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's truth is often stranger than fiction.
Yeah, that's the wild part of it. Yes, they did. Pete Davidson's character did actually run naked for a mile in a thunderstorm.
Yeah, I can believe that though. Somehow, yeah. Like that was entirely like didn't have plausible. To have a second pencil. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So, Kyle, this is kind of a very, very recent piece of history. I think most of us kind of vaguely remember the time that, like, Reddit took on Wall Street. I mean, how much did you understand about this story when you were coming into this movie?
Oh, my God. Almost nothing. I don't understand the stock market. I am not as financially literate as I should be as a 29-year-old. I'm better. I think that, like, for the most part, our education system does not encourage financial literacy in the United States. Two, I could have done it myself.
Also, bad news for this side of the Atlantic. It's not great.
Two, I didn't really understand what was going on, when it was happening, and I didn't really care. This was like a side of the internet that even as I consider myself extremely online, I'm not that online. And so watching the movie, I just kept thinking of this one YouTube video that came out during the GameStop thing as it was happening. And it was done by this comedian, Avalon Penrose. And the video is how a normal person tries to describe the GameStop thing. And it's very funny. And it's this very bright, chipper, young blonde woman, very excited to explain it. And then as she's explaining it, she realizes she does not know what she's talking about. And she looks like she is about to cry. And that's how I felt the entire time watching this movie. And she's like, I don't know what's going on. I don't understand how any of this is working. I can't tell if I'm too stupid or the film is not doing a good enough job. And I did feel, I've seen The Big Short, which a movie that I quite like. And I just thinking, it would be nice if like some celebrity paused and looked me straight in the eye to explain it to me like I was a child. And so the problem that I felt watching this movie was that this ongoing feeling that there was a simpler way to frame it without having to lose like the nuance to the financial aspect. And that was the idea that it's a gambling movie. Like, I understand gambling. I love playing poker. I have a monthly poker game with some friends. I don't gamble much outside of that, but like I'm sort of like nominally interested in those intricacies and whatnot. And as opposed to sort of like breaking it down or at least framing it as a bunch of players sort of trying to beat the casino, which is said like once very late into the film, they were really bent on trying to preserve both the internet aspect of it and the Wall Street aspect of it. And I was like, I don't really care about any of these people. I think Gillespie sort of set himself up with a difficult job in terms of trying to articulate this sense of community, especially not only in a time when like we are all isolated, but also in a time when community is such a diffuse term that exists on the internet across different backgrounds, different landscapes, different terrains, et cetera, et cetera. And so it felt like two different kinds of movies, neither of which were necessarily fully formed, in that like one was a gambling movie and the other was like a movie that was trying to articulate the language or the aesthetics of this side of the internet, this being Reddit and like 4chan and whatnot.
Yeah, I kind of came in with like almost at the opposite end of the spectrum. I don't understand money at all. But Elena Lazek, who was a previous guest on this thing, recommended a podcast to me called If Books Would Kill. And they did like an incredible deep dive into like the whole of Reddit GameStop phenomenon. So I came into it knowing like an intense amount of detail and knowing kind of the aftermath as well. So I wasn't kind of really there for information. I was kind of there for like the weird little character actor turns that everybody mm-hmm. did. But I'm amazed that you were not at least warm to like Anthony Ramos. Like, he's so charming in this as like the GameStop clerk who puts all of his like family finances on the line. No,
I love that for him. I mean, I liked when he was doing the Savage TikTok dance.
What's not to love with that? David, I mean, like, where did you come in with this? Like, did you have a good sense of what had happened with this Reddit take on of Wall Street? Or were you kind of coming into it just like a vague memory of like, oh, that was a thing people talked about online for a bit?
I mean, I was kind of like, I was vaguely aware of it happening in the background when it happened, you know, as with most things like NFTs and all these kind of things, I'm sort of like, I'll make maybe one attempt to work out what's going on. And if that doesn't happen, then I'm just going to back off and carry on with my life. And that's kind of what
NFTs are over. It turns out they're worthless now. So we don't need to learn that. Yeah.
What a surprise.
Just erase it. Anything you've learned.
But I guess I was maybe coming to this as I think my interest was more in the kind of Craig Gillespie auteurism. You know, he's a kind of new tabloid dude. Now his whole thing seems to be to take these quite ostensibly trashy stories about American public figures like Tonya Harding in I, Tonya, and Pam and Tommy, and make these kind of like quite glossy dramas, quite, you know, they're quite trashy in many ways, but there is a sort of hint of, you know, seriousness and trying to kind of mine something deeper about what these stories are saying about society and whatnot. And it seems that this is a natural fit for him in that it was this kind of cultural phenom that burned brightly very quickly and sort of faded away. And I guess that the creation of this film was very much a race against time. And it seems that enough people could see the bigger arc and the bigger what this says about society and what and how this episode could channel into what is the film's ultimate message very early on. I mean, it's the app that they use is called Robin Hood, and there is a sort of Robin Hood, like, you know, steal from the rich to feed the poor kind of vibe to what's going on here. And the idea of the film is you have this character, Keith Gill, who, aka Roaring Kitty, that is his online avatar, who does these stock market videos on YouTube, and people like him because he's very open about his bets and what he spent his money on, and he shows his, you know, he has his balance sheet as his background. In the film, he's played by Paul Dano, and Paul Dano does this very kind of quite sort of laconic, charming, you know, he's quite working class father of one who's self-taught in the world of finance and has just had this kind of, you know, he's had this thing that he wants to follow. He's had an idea. He's had a bit of a, you know, he's done the math and he thinks, yeah, I'm going to just do this. And what he's done is he's spotted that these big hedge funds that are kind of like corporate jackals in many ways, looking for the corpses of, you know, soon to be failed corporate enterprises. In this case, a sort of high street computer game store called GameStop, who I imagine, are they quite ubiquitous in the US, or is it sort of a mall thing?
They're fairly ubiquitous. They are in every mall, and even in New York, there are like individual brick and mortar stores.
Yeah. So they're betting against these companies, and then the idea is that they will kind of dive in when they fail. They dive in, asset strip them, and they make their money off of those. But this guy is he's rallying these people online to buy stocks in the company, despite the fact that, you know, it has been earmarked as one that is destined to fail. And he's driving the stocks in the other direction. So he's actually making the stock prices go up and up and up and up. And that is hitting back at the hedge fund investors. And, you know, the film kind of documents this pressure point where we get to see some, you know, there's I guess it's sort of like there's a sort of basic enjoyment in seeing, you know, slick Wall Street jackal types feeling harried and stressed, and they're losing like millions, if not billions, of dollars due to this little guy and his webcam. And yeah, the film is ultimately sort of, there are no real winners in the end of it. Like, the film is essentially about how, I mean, sort of decrying the fact how the people with the money, the people in Wall Street, the people who kind of like to do these things on their own without the scrutiny of like the dumb money, which is what the title refers to, which is the sort of small fry investors. They can very easily kind of manipulate things from behind the scene and move the goalposts. And the whole idea of it is that the little man can never win in these situations. Even if they are ever seen to be winning, then that will be considered a loophole which will need to be closed quickly. But, you know, it's kind of interesting in that sense. And I think that if the film is effective on any level, it's kind of it kind of provokes a sort of sense of anger and injustice. But I'm not sure, it's not maybe a massively surprising emotion to be feeling about this kind of subject matter.
See, my problem with the movie is that I didn't feel angry enough. Like, to me, and this is maybe due to not being as financially literate, all this feels like very, very abstract. And it's like, I understand the idea definitely of like different kinds of CEOs exploiting different systems to make more money. But I wasn't interested in the way that it was trying to engage with the CEOs betting against something, like it felt like so intangible. It felt like the stakes were like very, very ephemeral. And even when I think some of the characters who decide to hold and not like sell their shares, they're like, oh, we have this money, but in theory, like they don't actually have anything unless they sell. So it seemed like a little too ephemeral to me, although I am definitely on board with the notion of like a sort of Craig Gillespie auteurism. Having not seen Pam and Tommy, but I've seen his other films, one of the things I really love about I, Tonya is that even though it is occasionally like thuddingly blunt, there is like kind of a snarl to it. It has the pure force of Tonya Harding and Margot Robbie's anger fueling it, whereas like none of the characters here felt interesting enough to power through some sort of like fury that would sort of set the entire film alight. I mean, what I find interesting about I, Tonya is that like there's the direct address, and I think there's this like nod to the idea that we are looking at this artificial recreation of events that's totally tied to this woman's subjectivity. And this is, I think, trying to play it a little bit more objective and more docudrama. And there wasn't enough like formal ingenuity here. And I don't think collaging a bunch of TikToks counts as that.
But I think this, the subject matter itself is kind of detrimental to that. Like it's so complicated that by having kind of like, you know, unreliable narrator or presenting it from certain vantages or perspective, you're adding another layer onto an already like super complex setup. So it's kind of lose-lose.
Like the stock market.
Yeah, exactly, indeed.
I'm coming into it with like, I'm saying like this like I'm an expert. I listened to a few podcasts on the subject, but I kind of came into it like knowing the aftermath quite a lot. And so what I kind of understood of this is like, not only is this kind of like a takedown of like this toxic Wall Street world, but this is a formation of a cult. Like, if you look at the state of this current Wall Street world, they genuinely believe that the GameStop stock at present, if they sell, will make every single member of that Reddit community the richest person who has ever lived. And that is statistically true. Like, this is what they sincerely believe. So, like, I came into it being like, I am watching kind of something toxic form in relation to something that is already very, very insidious. So I kind of knowing the conclusion, maybe I just actually had a lot of joy in kind of looking at the like kind of character performances. I really like Sebastian Stan in this. I think Pete Davidson has like the range, the size of 3 millimeters, but this was about it for him. Like, that worked.
I liked America Ferrera.
Did you?
I just like America Ferrera as a presence on my screen. Like, she doesn't get to do a lot, and I think one of the problems with the movie is the way that like establishes its ensemble is that these people don't know each other, and so they have to very quickly establish like where they exist on sort of like moral spectrum and why we should root for them, yada yada yada. And so they all end up being like different versions of archetypes, while most of the focus is on Paul Dano and Seth Rogen. It seems more like the film probably would have been tighter if it had focused on those two characters, even though the sort of communal aspect of the internet is like an important part of the event itself. I just think that Gillespie's attempt to look at working class America in this film just doesn't feel as authentic as it has in some of his previous work.
Well, I think that's very fair. But Carl, do you want to get some scores on this before we move on? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect, out of 5.
I would say 3, 3, 2. Oh, I do want to note that the use of hip-hop music in this is wild. So wild. Considering,
it's
so good. most of the music is very good. Most of the characters in this movie are white. And it's like they're trying to approximate some... They keep using the term gangster, and they use it to describe Paul Dano's character. Like, you're a guy behind your computer.
But yeah, this is kind of what happened to me, I have to say, when I was pregnant. I used to play DJ Khaled's All I Do Is Win, Win, Win into my pregnant belly just so my kids would come out like super confident. Like, I feel like that is actually the way that you kind of drive ambition.
I love that.
David, sorry, that's a weird detail to share with listeners. David, what about you in terms of scores?
I'd probably go same. It was a sort of enjoyable little diversion. I don't think it's going to be anyone involves like favorite film on their own CV, including Craig Gillespie. I mean, I think it's, if someone said, should I see this? I'd be like, yeah, I think it's worth, you know, it's worth 90 minutes or so. And, you know, I think it gives a sense of this kind of these big financial ructions that are happening, and that it's not all just evil Wall Street types being evil.
Yeah, I think I'm probably at a, I'm going to cheat because I'm allowed to, probably like a 2, 4, 3.5.
Yeah.
I thought it was really good fun. I thought it was very interesting. I like the use of kind of that whole thing of like, when will they gonna sell as like a tool for suspense. And I gotta say, Carl, I didn't like America Ferrera in this at all, but everybody else. And like the jump scare of Dane DeHaan taking off his COVID mask and revealing that it was him with braces. Like, when have I felt joy like that before?
Oh, that was Dane DeHaan?
You didn't realize that was Dane DeHaan?
No. Oh, my God.
You just saw the braces.
I just saw the braces.
Okay. Well, that's...
your comment makes me want to have a child by a surrogacy and have them play the Flawless remix.
Wow. If I'm here on this earth for nothing else, like, that'll be a solid... But yeah, next up, let's get into Strange Way of Life by Pedro Almodóvar.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
After 25 years, Silver rides a horse across the desert to visit his sheriff, Jake. They celebrate the meeting, but the next morning Jake tells him that the reason for his trip is not just to go down the memory lane. So David, this is Almodovar's second foray into English language. He did a short with Tilda Swinton, I don't know, I think it was like 2.5 years ago, kind of like, it was early pandemic. It was a very much a pandemic film. Now that he's kind of freed of those constraints, like, what did you think of Strange Way of Life?
I really liked it, actually. And yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to see that a bit of a reaction. I mean, I say see a reaction. Look at my followers on Letterboxd who are maybe a little bit cooler on it than I am. I kind of found that it does a lot. It's kind of a half an hour film. And I think it manages to capture and do a lot in its 30 minutes. Although it's sort of described as a queer Western, I mean, and that applies in the sense that it is about a gay couple who are kind of rekindled. And it's very apposite that we're talking about Brokeback Mountain after this, because it almost feels like a little bit of a precursor to Brokeback Mountain. Like, you know, you could see how these stories connect in some ways, and Almodovar was, you know, it was a film that at one point he was mooted to be making himself, so like this almost feels like a little bit of a belated nod to that, the film that could have been. It keys more into his tendency towards melodrama, and it is more of a kind of florid Serkian melodrama than it is a film that links to, you know, Anthony Mann or John Ford and the kind of classic Western makers. Another film it reminded me of, and that he's talked about, is A Johnny Guitar, Nicholas Ray, especially in its kind of, you know, use of these very, very bright reds and yellows. You've got Saint Laurent, who've done the costumes for it, which are all very gorgeous. There's an element of anachronism to them, and like a sort of modernist winking touch to it, and which also comes through the production design, where you have these quite, although the settings are very much keyed into the classic Western, like shacks and prospecting towns and corrals and things like that. You know, you have these guys, and they've got these very strange paintings on the wall. Immaculate production design. And I think that I found it very moving, especially the script is very pared back, and Ethan Hawke's character has this incredible final monologue that you think is going to be this long speech, but ends up being this very kind of pithy comment, and the film sort of just fades out, and it's a very, very beautiful ending, I found. But I mean, you know, I would caveat all of that by saying that, you know, I am very few Pedro Almodovar films I don't adore. So, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to make something that I'm not kind of, if not on board with, then psychologically forcing myself to be on board with. So there.
Yeah. One of our filmmakers that don't miss. I mean, like, Kyle, for you, like, I mean, obviously there's kind of films that are about queer people, and then there are films that actually kind of don't just take queer people and insert them into, like, heteronormative narratives. I'm like, was this kind of something that actually explored something that was, you know, more subversive than just kind of doing, I suppose, like a Pride and Prejudice, but it's two men or two women, you know what I mean?
I think that he is trying to do something along those lines. One of the reasons why I love Almodovar is for his ability to really interrogate and deconstruct our attachment to genre, and the way that he just sort of amps up every component and every trope to be as blazingly conspicuous as possible, to help us recognize those elements of storytelling and the way that they often shape identity itself. I think he's quite similar to Todd Haynes in that way, honestly. But I just was not on board for Strange Way of Life. It just feels, this and The Human Voice just don't feel as adroit or as refined as I want them to be. I think this is better than The Human Voice. There is a little bit more of a textural quality to the production design and the cinematography, but even then, I was hoping for something like weird. It's not very weird. And even though he's placing the melodrama within the Western, I think a lot of Westerns do have melodramatic components within them, like My Darling Clementine and True Grit and Johnny Guitar, as we were, as David mentioned earlier. And so this just felt like, it felt a little slapdash at times. And maybe that would have been fixed if the film were longer and there's more time to sort of massage out the different genre components that he is trying to call attention to, like the way that that Pedro Pascal and Ethan Hawke talk about the past and talk about their who they were as younger people and the fact that they haven't spoken in over 25 years. The way that that is presented just feels a little on the nose and indelicate and sort of devoid of either poetry through the camera or poetry through language. So I was just fairly disappointed. It's not bad. It's just like fine. It just feels sort of insubstantial. And I wish, and I also have this impression that like Almodovar has gotten a little softer and more sentimental with age, because even though a lot of his movies spend quite a bit of time looking towards the past, there's always this like edge to it. He's always like playing with something to keep the audience on their toes about how we think about memory and how we think about the past lives that we have either lived or could have lived. And here it's just very soft and kind of banal and a little bit ends up being a little bit domestic. And this is following in a trend of like Julieta and Pain and Glory and The Human Voice, where it's all like very, very sentimental in a manner that I don't especially care for. But what are you going to do? I'm happy that he's been being given the money to make these, but I hope he is able to bring on someone to like work on the script with him a little bit more, because it's just not there for me. The best part is Manu Rios singing, honestly. His green eyes are really beautiful.
Oh, yeah. I have to say I was utterly charmed by it. I do fully understand where you were coming from, but it just, those sort of like rapid fire tonal shifts like really worked for me. And I just found it like an utter joy. But do you think there was something maybe lost in him coming into the English language, like a little bit of poetry maybe?
Yeah, I imagine that some of that dialogue would sound really gorgeous in Spanish. But in English, it just sounds very, very direct and blunt. And it's not helped by the fact that I don't think Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal have any chemistry together. They're both giving like different kinds of Almodovar performances. And neither of them, like Ethan Hawke is trying to be like a little bit grittier and more naturalistic. And Pedro Pascal is like very effortful in the way that he's trying to signal to Ethan Hawke that he's there to flirt, that he has this desire and feeling. But I just don't really buy that there's a connection between the two. Or that they're able to sort of key into the way that Almodovar channels or articulates desire and yearning, especially between like two long lost loves, which is like a favorite theme of his. I don't believe the two were ever together, never mind like rekindling anything.
Well, perhaps that's just kind of like my flights of fancy of that, like, I truly believe that I have such intense chemistry with both of those actors that kind of, perhaps that, you know, they didn't need to have much together because it was, you know, I was bringing that all to the equation.
I'm sorry to be such a hater on this podcast. Yeah.
No, not at all. I mean, you're so phenomenally insightful. I'm questioning my taste.
No, don't question your taste. This is your truth in your movies.
But David, like now, I mean, we've had these tentative steps with The Human Voice and now A Strange Way of Life, these kind of shorts with Almodovar going into English language. I mean, are you excited for maybe this kind of like second wave where he's going to come out of Spanish language? Because I'm kind of in two minds myself, because I just want to watch lots of Penelope Cruz and Antonio Banderas collaborations with him.
Yeah, it's interesting. Apparently he's going to do a trilogy of shorts and they're going to all potentially be released as like a single film. So like, I think he's going to try and maybe reverse engineer some connectivity between this and Human Voice, because I have to say I don't see that much on currently, but maybe he'll do a third one which will make them all kind of coalesce in a way.
I mean, in the words of Aretha Franklin's Gowns, beautiful gowns.
he I mean he was set to actually do a movie of his first big English language movie was going to be an adaptation of Lucia Berlin's short stories, a collection called A Manual for Cleaning Women. I don't know if you've ever encountered those, but they're brilliant. They're about kind of the sort of stories of a catty and insightful cleaning lady, and that was going to be with Cate Blanchett, and that's no longer happening apparently, which is really sad, because I remember I interviewed him for when he came over for Parallel Mothers, and I said how excited I was for it, and he seemed very excited for it too back then, but now it's not happening, so I don't know what his current plans are. But yeah, I like this film, and I do understand and accept criticism on it. I know that makes me sound very haughty, but like yeah, this, I think the pleasures that I got from it were the kind of quote marks that it uses. And I think even down to the dialogue and the chemistry there was, and the translation into English emphasized the fact that he is, as you say, paying homage to genre, re-quoting, recalibrating almost the cliches of the genre, but with this, with the kind of queer twist. And you know, it's the little twists and the little changes that he's making in the backdrop and the with the use of music and you know, there's almost a kind of comic element as well to it. I mean, there's a sort of absurd comic pastiche element to it as well, like, you know, almost Blazing Saddles-esque kind of meta commentary on westerns that I enjoyed as well. But yeah, I guess the chemistry element. I mean, you know what, I will say, more of a general point is that I don't have the ability to judge chemistry on screen. I don't think I've ever thought they have chemistry, they don't have chemistry. I just, how do you judge that?
Not even Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung in The Mood for Love?
Yeah, I guess that, you know.
You know what, there was one recently, Cat Person.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That is like the most anti-chemistry bullshit I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, that had all of the sort of like sexual tension of like a prostate exam from your grandparent. Like,
don't threaten me Jesus with a good Christ. Time.
Wow.
It's more you can see it when it's not there.
Right.
I think.
Right, right. Yeah, I would agree with that. Or it's like porn, you know it when you see it. I definitely see what you're saying, David, and I wanted more of that. I wanted more and bigger and louder quotes. Like, that's what's interesting about queer filmmakers taking on traditionally heteronormative genres, because they have the power of not only sort of inserting ourselves into it, yada, 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 but taking the things that audiences take for granted as cliches of heteronormativity and turning them on their head or deranging them in some way or making them so much weirder and more apparent that they are part of this like broader construct of how we learn how to desire and navigate the world and whatnot. And I just didn't feel that was as strong or as pointed as it has been in previous work, like Broken Embraces or Women on the Verge or anything like that. It just felt like a little tame for my taste. But again, Manouvrios looking in the camera, I honestly like think that the film could have just been that one shot. And I think it would convey, like, the most interesting thing to me about the movie beyond that shot is the meta narrative around it, that this is like his chance to do the movie that he didn't get to do, to play with the genre and the form in the way that he didn't get a chance to do back when he had the opportunity to do so, yada, yada, yada. And that there's like this melancholy, like the sentimentality of his last like bunch of movies is paired understandably with a sense of melancholy and a sense of aging and a realization of life and love's sort of finite quality. And I think you get that all in Manouvrios's face and his eyes. Like I think he's able to convey that paradoxical mix of wanting and not having and being able to like look deep within the audience's soul without having to do like a ton of work. And I really love that one shot. And I think it is able to say everything that the rest of the film, I think, struggles to do.
Well, I personally like it when a film in its final moments just kind of becomes misery. But Carl, do you want to put some scores on this before we move on to a queer classic?
I would say 3-2-2.
being very stingy today, but I like it. This is, you know, you're fulfilling the criticism element of critic. David, what about you?
I'd probably give it 4s across the board.
Yeah, I think I'm probably at a 5.44. I can see what you're talking about, Kyle, in terms of like the lack of substance, but perhaps I am able to just take a little style of a substance, and something like that emerald green jacket just brings me to such a level of joy when I'm watching Pedro Pascal. And, you know, it's a film that zigged when I thought it was going to zag. And that's something I always appreciate. Yeah. Next up, it's Film Club. In 1963, Radio Cowboy Jack and Ranch Hand Ennis are hired as sheep herders in Wyoming. One night on Brokeback Mountain, Jack makes a drunken pass at Ennis that is eventually reciprocated. Though Ennis marries his longtime sweetheart and Jack marries his fellow rodeo rider, the two men keep up a tortured and sporadic affair over the course of 20 years. So yeah, I think my only note for this is like, how the hell did Crash win Best Picture over Brokeback Mountain? I'm still angry. It's been, what, has it been 20 years? It's been about 20 years and I'm still angry.
That was the very first Oscar telecast that I ever watched, and I remember the reaction. And even at home, I don't think I'd seen enough movies to be as invested in the whole horse race of it all, but I was aware that Brokeback Mountain was a good and an important movie, and I think I had seen it on DVD at that point. But when they announced Crash, I was like, what's going on here? That was like wild. I remember sitting on like my burgundy carpet that we had in the house, watching the TV in the living room. I'm just like, this is not correct. What's going on here?
Yeah. What were we on in 2005 that this could be overlooked? I mean, such stunning performances from Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal. I mean, like, does it bother you at all, Kyle, that these, like, kind of something that is like an iconic gay romance is played by two, well, at least publicly, straight actors?
My favorite topic, gay actors playing gay roles. My opinion is that I don't care. If it makes sense for the story, there are other people involved who are making these casting choices, and if they believe that it is right for the story and the actors come in with empathy and a desire to commit to whatever the guiding vision of the project is, then sure. I think there are definitely lines to be drawn, especially with regards to casting trans characters. But one of the things that frustrates me about that conversation and discourse is that it's really centered around the idea of employment opportunity. Like, the desire is for people in front of the camera and behind the camera of marginalized communities to be able to have the power to tell their own stories and to assert presence within an industry that has previously kept them out, which I think is absolutely necessary, absolutely needed. I don't think anyone will have any arguments with that. But when people essentialize it to this person must be of that same sexual identity, you do have to call into question, like, what does that mean to perform as a gay person or as a queer person or as a lesbian? Yes, there are like cultural signifiers, but lots of those cultural signifiers don't apply to lots of people living in different spaces or communities where it's either not acceptable or it's not the dominant language in which those people communicate with one another in those communities. So I think it is, I think that conversation needs a rebrand and a focus on being able to encourage and argue for queer people to be part of the creative process more holistically, whether it be as producers or screenwriters or directors or cinematographers, not just as actors, because I think there are so many, and not just for directors either. I think as long as people are committed to doing the research and going in with good faith about whatever project it is, there are so many examples of actors playing queer characters who, like, just because, also, like, just because you're gay doesn't mean you're a good actor. There are so many bad gay actors, like Neil Patrick Harris, sorry.
Yeah, pretty terrible.
But Ang Lee, I mean, it was Brokeback Mountain.
Worst Hedwig with the angry inch, I'm going to say on record.
Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain isn't even the first time that he's extended his interest and his desire to share stories from queer people. He made The Wedding Banquet in like 1995, I believe. And that is the story of like a gay Taiwanese white couple in New York, one of the Taiwanese half getting married to their like tenant because she needs green card. And it's this really delightful farce about the clash between like modernity and tradition and whatnot. But Ang Lee is not publicly facing a gay or queer person. And the actor in that, I don't think, was either. Joe Lichtenstein, the son of the artist, Roy Lichtenstein, is in that movie, and I believe he is gay. But anyway, my point is, it doesn't, like, the fact that what is more important is that Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal give really great performances. Although I think the best performance goes to Anne Hathaway.
Not that wig. I'm sorry, Kyle. You could see a performance behind that wig. You're a better critic than I.
The wig is, well, I'm sorry, I mean Anne Hathaway's wig gets best performance.
Okay. David, you said you don't recognize chemistry, but like surely you can see the chemistry between Jake and Heath in this one.
Yeah, maybe I'm being a bit silly asking that, but yeah, my chemistry radar is off. Yeah, no, I just to go back to what you guys were talking about just then about gay actors, and I would say, like, not that the film needs defending in this way, but like there is a certain aspect of it that feels appropriate, where you have this, you know, ultra masculine backdrop of, you know, male kind of cowboy, kind of in the sort of post trad cowboy era. They're now kind of looking after sheep rather than steer, and it kind of feels appropriate that the unlikeliness, you know, of these characters happening to mine that sense of their own kind of emotional depths and desires, kind of means that for them being played by, you know, outwardly straight actors does almost have a little bit of a thematic resonance as well. Like I hadn't seen it since it came out. I saw it in the cinema when it came out, and you know, just it was part of the, you know, there was a lot of hype around it, and it was, you know, it was considered the front runner. And I mean, I don't recall them in much detail, but I do definitely remember there being, you know, a pre social media outcry about, you know, homophobia, and a gay story could never win the big prize in Hollywood because, you know, it would be a turn off for too many people who are interested in the Academy and what their values are. I actually suspect that it losing helped to kind of start more conversations than maybe it would have had it won, and sort of push things forward for the future for films like Moonlight. I mean, I guess I think watching it again has made me kind of yearn for the Ang Lee of Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, Wedding Banquet, and you know, the ice storm, Crouching Tiger, even, you know, like there was an era, sort of late 90s, early noughts, where he was like super reliable filmmaker. You know, he was going to, you know, at the very least, he was going to do something really interesting and a bit weird. And he's kind of, I don't know what his deal is at the moment, but he's kind of fallen into this kind of high frame rate 3D world that just doesn't seem to suit him at all, really.
Don't you dare besmirch the name of Gemini Man in front okay. of me.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, get your check, King, as
Let's
they say.
Save that for another podcast. But, like, but yeah, you know, I know it's very, very centrist dad of me to say so, but, like, you know, I would love him to kind of go back and do, I guess, a kind of, you know, this kind of very Eastwoodian film. Watching it again, definitely, you know, I thought, you know, I'd love to see this double build with Bridges in Madison County. You know, it's got a kind of robustness, and it's a very slow film. It's a very detailed, delicate, assertive film that just is focused on very small details. I mean, I think we could just go on about it forever. I think the one thing that I really you know, that got me back into it very, very quickly is, so the first half an hour of the film is the kind of the coiled potential romance between these two guys, Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger. They're out up on Brokeback Mountain doing their shepherding, and most people will know in advance of seeing the film where it goes and what it's about. But I think it introduces their desires in a really quite remarkable and subtle way. And I feel that Ang Lee has told the actors to not project it and not show it. And he's actually kind of showing it through very, very subtle camera moves and framings and choreography, rather than having them overtly signpost where things are going to go. And when it does eventually happen, it, you know, it's a cold night, and, you know, they are kind of upholding their their sort of macho ideals, and one of them's in the tent and one of them's outside the tent even though it's freezing cold, so they come into the tent together. And yeah, it's very sudden and quite surprising, but actually no, it makes kind of makes sense at the same time. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's it kind of builds this real kind of like emotional bedrock for the film. And I think that seeing it kind of play out over decades is fascinating and moving. And yeah, I think Michelle Williams is great in a kind of role before she really broke out. If I have one criticism of it, maybe this is a bit weak, but it's a film that I didn't feel the passing of time. Like I don't think it does enough to suggest that time has passed. The only real barometer of that is the children that they have growing up. There's a bit of facial hair, there's some sideburns. It doesn't do a lot to give a sense of a sort of sweeping tragedy that's occurring over this large period of time. That's probably my only big criticism of it.
I guess because Heath Ledger was so kind of like my generation's teenage heartthrob that almost going back to it, it's like there's a sense of mourning in that passage of time. Like watching him in this feels so precious, knowing that like how little else we'll get, if that makes sense. But yeah, before we move on, Kyle, any last thoughts on Brokeback Mountain?
I really, the thing that really appeals to me about Brokeback Mountain is it's like the thing happens and then they have to deal with the ripple effects of how it shapes their sense of interiority, how they are sort of questioning their own sort of masculine ideals through the rest of it as they like have a family and are in town, yada, yada, yada. And so I really struck by that attention to detail, how you can see like that kind of internal ambivalence shape how they're interacting with different people when they're apart from each other, when they're leading their own lives.
God, I'm going to try not to break into tears. I just feel so sad now. I miss Heath Ledger. And the final scene in this film just stabs me in the heart. But yes, okay, you guys are going to perk me up with our final one last thing where you're going to give us a non-movie recommendation. Kyle, what is your non-movie recommendation that you're going to give listeners this week?
My non-movie recommendation is Agatha Christie's Poirot with David Suchet, the great actor to play Hercule Poirot. I've been on a murder mystery kick lately, and by lately I mean the last 2 years. And there is something that is both extremely comforting about how certain and how reliable murder mysteries are. They have a structure, you know, that justice will eventually be served. They're pretty standard like morality plays. But I think what's really interesting about watching the series chronologically is that you see the change in creative direction as it was being passed from like ITV to A&E to like whatever. And it goes from like a much more, a somewhat like refined or like mustier version of like of Art Deco style. And then as it gets into the 2000s, you see that they're doing this proto-prestige aesthetic where you've got candid angles and extreme close-ups of like random objects and insert shots. And this is also when David Suchet was getting like really Calvinist, so the show gets really, really religious at the same time. And that version of Murder on the Orient Express is with Jessica Chastain, a young Jessica Chastain, gets really, really Jesus-y. And that is very interesting because it allows some of the darker elements that are in Christie's books to really come to the fore. Because even though we are familiar with Agatha Christie and those sorts of murder mysteries as being cozy watches, I think she's actually quite a capable writer in terms of examining human nature and how cruel and evil, the kind of cruel and evil that lurks within all humanity. And what I like about this series is the way that it finds different ways to channel that through its visuals and through its settings and also guest stars. There are like lots of random people you would not expect to show up in these things, like Michael Fassbender. But yes, my recommendation is Agatha Christie's Poirot which is streaming on BritBox.
Oh, yeah, I'm in such agreement with you. Even though I actually think that the recent Haunting in Venice was probably the best of the series, I don't understand why they have to start every Poirot movie or brand feels the need to do it with like, Poirot is really over being a detective. And it's the same thing they do with Bond, where it's just like, he doesn't want to be a spy anymore. And it's just like, we can have more of an arc than this.
My cultural highlight is, this is a bit of a weird one, but a couple of weeks ago, maybe over a bit longer than that, we talked about on Film Club, the Merchant Ivory Morris adapted from E.M. Forster novel.
Yeah, Hugh Grant's
and
Peak.
With Hugh Grant. And enjoyed that. And I had a bit of serendipity when I was having a drink with my friend who told me that Howard's End by E.M. Forster was his favourite book of all time. And so I was like, well, this is too much. So I recently picked it up and I'm reading Howard's End by Ian Forster. I'm only halfway through at the moment, and I'm going to try and sort of wrap it up this weekend. But I mean, I don't think we need to go into to Howard's End right now.
Very
but
good.
It's extraordinary book, I'm going to pick up Passage to India and probably read that next. So yeah, I'm Forster pilled.
Well, I mean, as you should be. God, I love Howard's End. Okay, maybe I'm not taking on any new culture. Maybe I'm just revisiting both of those, actually. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's Man vs. AI in The Creator. It's Man vs. Sadistic Puppet in Saw X. And for Film Club, we see how the horror franchise got its start in 2004's Saw. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leigh Lateef, and my guests this week were Kyle Turner and David Jenkins. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.